Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us on WCTCAM or restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
Just ducky.
Yeah, doing well?
Yeah. I was reflecting upon our recent trip to New Orleans, and there are some lessons that I learned. I guess they're lessons that I knew, but the things that you talk about that really we saw in practice. And one of the things I wanted to bring up, there were two things we wanted to bring up. There were two famous, expensive restaurants in New Orleans that were historical New Orleans restaurants, mm-hmm. but that are not artifacts of history. They're restaurants that are busy, and not just with tourists. They're recognized as being a place that we would consider going
premium,
to eat.
Premium restaurants.
Well, and we were going to go to eat there. I mean, so it, what, you know, I'm not going for the mm-hmm. the touristy thing,
right?
And I think I want to point out two things that happened that had a tremendous impact.
Well, I know one of them. Francis and I were standing out in front of one of the restaurants and considering where we were going to go for lunch. A famous restaurant that we're not going to mention the name right now.
But it's hard to get a reservation. The waiters wear tuxedos. Mm-hmm. It's nice.
And it's right on Bourbon Street. And as Francis and I were getting ready to go in, out front there was a waiter smoking a cigarette, which, frankly, you know, you can't smoke indoors anymore. I didn't have a huge problem with.
Actually, you can in New Orleans.
Oh, but, that's right. You can in New Orleans.
But also, if you're gonna go to New Orleans with the idea that if they smoke there, I don't want to be near them, it's time to leave New Orleans. But, okay, so we go in. This guy's outside the restaurant.
And he's out front, and he is a slovenly mess.
Right, he's got and it's worse when you're a slovenly mess with a tuxedo on.
He's got a tuxedo that he's obviously worn many times without cleaning. His shirt is stained and dirty. And like I said, it's not you just spilled something on yourself, because that happens in a restaurant sometimes. But this is clearly things that have been on his uniform for quite some time. And I just thought, I don't want to go in there.
And we didn't. And we literally, I was reaching for the door handle. I looked at the stuff on his shirt and the stuff on his tuxedo, and he was one of the captains, and I thought, there's lots of restaurants in this town.
And know that Francis and I, at the time, did not speak, did not make eye contact, did not do anything like that. We both independently said, I don't want to eat here.
And what's funny is, I was reaching for the door handle, and then it's just sort of my hand went by. They must have thought we were very strange. And we walked about half a block away, and I think the conversation was, did you see that? And you said, yeah. And that was it. But the other thing I was amazed at is, while there's so much great food in New Orleans.
There was a lot of great food. I cannot tell
and
why.
And so much really friendly service.
Very interesting.
And the one restaurant that stands out is August by John Besh.
No question.
Unbelievable restaurant. Of course, our waiter was from Connecticut. but no, it was that's a restaurant we really recommend.
I will say, you know, service style was clearly different than it is here in the Northeast. So, you know, there are certain expectations that we have here that you wouldn't necessarily have there. So there were some things that were just plain different as far as service style goes. But at August, and I really enjoyed the food. I have no complaints about the food whatsoever. But it really was one of those places where the service was really, really good. You know, the meaning of a really good captain tableside, reads the table, knows what they want, takes care of everything that needs to get taken care of. It was just what it was supposed to be.
Well, you know, but there was one other restaurant, which also, you know, we don't really name the bad ones, but it was a famous New Orleans restaurant in the Bourbon Street area as well. And we happened to go there both for dinner, and then we got invited there for breakfast the next day. So we were two meals in a row at this place. It was expensive.
It was very expensive.
For what it was, I mean, entrees were $42. And mm-hmm. I'm not talking about the high-end steak was $42.
No. Entrees are $42 for brunch.
Right.
For brunch. We weren't, you know,
What were they for dinner?
You know what? I didn't pay that close attention to give you
but it wasn't cheap.
Number. It was an expensive restaurant.
It was brunch for two with a couple of cocktails, not even a couple.
Oh, I think we had there were seven of us at the table. I think three cocktails were had at the entire table.
So it was $75 a head for brunch. That's not inexpensive, especially considering it was
eggs. With no drinking. No, I mean, yeah, we had all drunk all night long and we're not ready to drink at brunch.
But I was amazed at the gaffe in service. The service wasn't great. Okay, and you know what? Sometimes the brunch waiters aren't the best waiters in the house. I get it. But the place, what we walked in and there were crumbs all over the floor, on the carpeted floor of this fine dining restaurant, and there was a table next to us that was unset when we walked in. We had brunch, we had three-course brunch and coffee, and I had a Bloody Mary. Actually, I had a Snapper, which is a Bloody Mary made with gin. It was delicious. But the crumbs were all over the floor, and it wasn't like a couple of crumbs. It was like a kid had played with a cracker or something. It was all over the floor. And, you know, if that happens when I'm walking in, that's fine, but it should be gone in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. And I was amazed at how people kept walking by it. And for a brunch, and we spent $700 on brunch for seven of us. It's really crazy, really crazy. But overall, though, I have to say, New Orleans food was great. I didn't know.
Very fun city, too. And you know, Francis and I aren't really into the touristy kinds of things, but a very fun city, lots of interesting history, lots of interesting historical places to go. I could see, you know, we spent 5 or 6 days there, and I could see us spending another 5 or 6 easily just hunting down the things that we didn't get to.
And more than a few cocktail bars. Well, let's talk about something that takes place. Did you know that historically, when Europeans hit the shores of the North America, that buffalo ranged as wide as down in Louisiana, down around where New Orleans is now. There were buffalo. Not anymore. We're going to talk to a gentleman named Stephen Ranella, who's written a book on buffalo and hunted one himself, and he's going to take us through that journey in just a moment, so stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we are talking today with Stephen Ranella. You may remember Stephen from our show where he came on and talked about his book, The Scavenger's Guide to O Cuisine. Well, there's a new book, American Buffalo in Search of a Lost Icon.
Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for letting me come back on again.
Yeah, Stephen, when you did Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine, you're kind of the guy who gave new meaning to the backyard barbecue.
<It's really good.
laughs> Well, I hope so. I don't know if I can take full claim for that, but I'd like to think I helped, yeah, maybe.
Little Brooklyn squirrel, some interesting stuff.
Now,
now I'm not pulling so much meat out of my backyard as I am veggies right now. I've kind of made my transition to the veggie season. So
I think people are really more comfortable with veggies out of their backyard than an animal that might wander through a suburban backyard or an urban backyard. You're in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, I'm living here. Well, I've been here. I got married, so you know that changes a guy's situation around considerably. And I was living in Alaska before I got married, but now, yeah, I'm here in Brooklyn, and I still got a place up there, so I spend a lot of time going back and forth.
Alaska to Brooklyn, you must really be in love.
Well, you know, it's warmer here. So.
Yeah.
Less likely to be killed by a bear, for example.
Yeah, for sure.
I understand
more
the male
squirrels and more squirrels.
I understand the male-female relationship up there is pretty bad, too.
Now, let's talk about your book, American Buffalo in Search of a Lost Icon. Why buffalo, and what did you find out about the buffalo? You actually hunted a buffalo.
Yeah, I first got really interested in the animal sort of as a species back in, it was around 99 or 2000. When I was hiking in the Madison Mountains in Montana, and I found a buffalo skull kind of eroding out of the ground. I later had that thing radiocarbon dated, and there's a 66% probability that that animal died within a couple decades of 1750. So I kind of thought of him as being sort of like a contemporary of George Washington in a way. You know?
Right.
And I thought of him as very much the American buffalo. But my interest in that animal continued, and then in 2005, I applied for a hunting permit to hunt for a wild buffalo in Alaska in the Wrangell Mountains. And every year they give out a handful of permits. The year in 2005, they gave out 24 permits through a lottery. There was 1,300 applicants.
Wow.
So it was a little bit less than a 2% chance of getting it, and I was one of the recipients. of the tag, and of those 24 people, four of us got a buffalo that year, and,
wow.
and I was one of the guys that got a buffalo. But I kind of practiced a sort of siege strategy. Not having a regular job, I have a lot of time to go walk around in the woods looking for animals. So,
Stephen, you know that's about the same percentage of books that are actually good
yeah, right.
that we read.
So I probably stretched my luck out when I had when I got the permit. So,
got the buffalo and the book.
Yeah, so I mean, so the book, my book, American Buffalo, follows that journey, follows that hunt in the Wrangell Mountains in Alaska, and then interweaving through that story of the skull I found, and also kind of the history of this animal, definitely our most iconic creature. The history of this animal from the Pleistocene, or the Ice Age, up into, it's a bonus material where I even go into the future a little bit. So, not many nonfiction books go into the future, but I take a few stabs at what the future might look like for this animal. And it's becoming more and more a bright future after a pretty shady past.
Now, the reemergence of the American bison. Bison and buffalo are pretty much the same thing, right? Two words for the same thing?
Pretty much. They're exactly the same thing.
So
let me comment on that real quick. Because people have been calling them buffalo for, 300 years. And then one day someone thought that there's going to be all this confusion because there's already a Cape buffalo in Africa and a water buffalo in Asia. So they thought they would clear up this confusion and give the buffalo a new name, bison, which is based on its Latin or Linnaean name, bison. So what they did by solving this confusion is created an enormous amount of confusion. And I have never in all my life said to someone that I found a buffalo skull in Montana and had them think that I found a water buffalo head. Ever. Never happened.
Well, now talk to us about the future, and then we'll go back and talk about your book in the past. But I found that to be fascinating. The American buffalo was on the verge of extinction, and it's come back rather dramatically. And one of the ways it's come back is there's a market for the meat of the buffalo, and it seems to be a well managed success story. Is that a fair characterization?
No, for sure. I mean, you get to very late 1800s, early 1900s. We had less than 1,000. There was a time when perhaps there were only about 75 left in the United States of America. An unknown number were in Canada. It turns out that maybe there was 300 or 400 in Canada at that time that hadn't been discovered up around Great Slave Lake. Now, and that is down from an estimated 32 to 38 million at the time of European contact. Now we're back up to 500,000 in North America, and that number grows steadily all the time. It's probably more than that now. And 96% of those are captive wildlife, because, that are raised in some degree for food or for a hobby or whatever, but they're owned by individuals.
I was
about 20,000 wild ones that exist on public lands in the wild that are free roaming. And the kind of thing about it is, it's at once depressing and at once very enlivening, is that we could have as many wild buffalo as we want, unlike other things that go extinct or might go extinct, that we'll never bring back. All you have to do with the buffalo is open the doors and they'll be back everywhere. But they're inconvenient, and there's a lot of forces that don't want them around.
Because
they tend to total out cars and barge through fences. So,
let me share with you my experiences. I was going through Yellowstone summer before last. I rode my motorcycle from Montana down to Utah, and we passed through Yellowstone, and we encountered a group there that was evidently, a certain number of the buffalo wander off Yellowstone every year, and then the I don't know whether it's the Park Service goes and has a helicopter hunt and just kills all the buffalo that sort of wander off the park. With the support of a lot of the local ranchers. And there's a group really opposed to that says we should allow them to be reintroduced into the wilds of, Wyoming. What are the pros and cons there? Is it just that they're so big and they run into cars? And there are all sorts of claims that they would spread disease to regular cattle. That the activists said was just hogwash. What's the politics behind that?
The politics, there's a code language involved, and I'm going to express my bias in this for sure.
There's
a code language involved in this where those buffalo, the ones living in Yellowstone National Park, carry a disease they got from cattle. They carry a European livestock disease called brucellosis. as do elk, which live in Yellowstone National Park and which come and go at will. And no one would ever suggest that we go gun down all the elk because there's a huge industry around hunting them and viewing them. I'm an avid elk hunter myself. What's really going on is that brucellosis thing is thrown around. What's really going on, what's at stake, is probably it comes down to access to grazing lands and private land issues. People view that because the buffalo was so reduced and there are so few of them, and there's a handful in the park, people view them as sort of having lost their wildlife status. They're not wild anymore. So to reintroduce them is sort of like springing something on someone. And people have grazing rights to some of that national forest land, and they just really don't want, in my opinion, in many people's opinion, they don't want to have to put up with the risk of losing access to grazing lands to this new wildlife species that's kind of being thrust upon them by the Park Service. So every year when the animals migrate out of that park, many of them get hazed back into the park, either by the Montana Department of Livestock or the National Park Service. Jurisprudence on that bounces back and forth, and a number of them get killed. There's a movement right now, which I support wholeheartedly, and it's, you know, being administered mostly by the Montana Department of Fish and Wildlife and Parks, is to decide what an acceptable number is to cull and allow private hunters to go in there and hunt those animals in a free, you know, in a free range, fair chase hunting atmosphere, and go in and hunt those animals and have the meat for their own family. And that's something that's going on a lot more. And you can go online and apply. Anybody in America can go online and apply for one of those permits and go do that hunt there. So to me, that's the answer to this problem, and it's a vexing problem. The answer to this problem will probably look more like a private hunting situation than a government hazing operation in the future.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of this. We had so many buffalo across the plains. The Europeans come. What do we do? What happens to get us down to 1,000 buffalo, perhaps, in the entire world?
Yeah, it's something that happens. You know, it's such a horrible story, but it's something that happened kind of like incrementally. There was maybe about 32 million on the Great Plains, and maybe between 4 and, you know, who knows, 4 and 10 million. The fashionable guess used to be 60 million, but that's been downgraded. It was kind of based on some rather bogus observations. So say there's 32 million on the Great Plains, another 4 to 8 million scattered around the points north, south, east, and west of there. Early people came through, you know, the French came through, and they found buffalo in New Orleans, on the coast of North Carolina. They were all over Ohio, Illinois, and Appalachians, Northern California. I mean, things are everywhere. At first, a lot of them were extirpated from their native range just from people hunting for sustenance. Like a guy goes into the, you know, a homesteader goes into the Appalachian Hills, sets up a cabin, shoots some buffalo around there. There aren't that many anyways, and he wipes them out. So that was the first phase of the extermination. The second phase of the extermination was Native American hide hunters who had access to the horse. They were supplying hides to European traders, supplying some meat to European traders, and they caused some more small-scale regional extinction. But the big thing that happened was around 1871, tanneries found a way to take these buffalo hides and make very suitable leather for them. And before then, buffalo leather wasn't that popular. It had very limited application. But they could make it very elastic, and it was good for industrial belting and footwear. And they started having standing orders for as many as they could get. And they didn't care about the hair anymore. They were only making leather. So it didn't matter what time of year you killed. It didn't matter if they had thick fur or not. Mm-hmm. So people could hunt them in the summertime. They could hunt them year-round. The money was really, really good. And in about 10 years, when this began, when this hide, they called it the hide boom, that began around 1871, like I said. At that time, there was maybe about 15 million left on the Great Plains, and those were gone by 1882.
Oh, my God.
It was like a dramatic spasm. And it was like people trying to make money.
And
I mean, you can dress it up, you know, like people dress it up and try to find these things about, you know, the evilness, the inherent evilness of America and all that. But it was basically like it was a good way to go make cash. And people did it, and they did it, and they didn't even really know what they were doing until it was over.
Stephen, and the hides became so valuable that people would even sometimes just leave all the meat on the plains and just skin them and take the hides.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, if they could have gotten a ton of money for the meat, they would have buried the railroad tracks in meat. But you couldn't get the meat back. Like, you take the hide and dry it down, right? And you're out in the Kansas plains. It's 90 degrees. It's July. You can dry a hide, air dry a hide, and sell it. There's nothing you can do to the meat. Maybe about, they guess, maybe about 1% of that meat made it to market. Usually tongues, salted, and put in barrels. But there's no way to move the meat. There was, you know, there wasn't a good infrastructure in place. And, yeah, they just didn't know. I mean, some people knew what was going on, and they said we should stop this. But the average guy who was doing it would be, you know, Civil War veterans who were out of work, you know, kids who were left home in their teens, which was kind of adventurers, you know, that wound up on the Great Plains. And I lived for a long time in Miles City, Montana. It said that in Miles City, Montana, that after they did the last big shoot, they killed around 500,000 or so buffalo outside of Miles City. That was the last big free-ranging herd. A lot of the people who founded Miles City and whose families live there ranching today are people who killed off that herd and just settled into town waiting for more to come down from Canada. There was always this assumption that more would show up. And years went by and years went by, and eventually they're like, wow, maybe there aren't any more.
They're all dead.
That was kind of like how it, you know, that was kind of like the end. It was, it surprised the big hunters as much as it surprised anybody else.
You know, when we come back, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk with you about this amazing animal and how it's adapted. And then I want to talk to you about the buffalo hunt and buffalo food. Buffalo's food. I think that's really fascinating. And of course, integral in the renaissance or the reemergence of the American buffalo is its place on the American dinner plate. So we'll be back in just a moment talking with Stephen Ranella about his book, American Buffalo in Search of a Lost Icon. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking today with Stephen Ranella about his book, American Buffalo in Search of a Lost Icon. Stephen, I want to talk about this amazing animal. I mean, I hear it can outrun a horse. I read that in your book. Did I get that right?
Yeah, in a short spurt. No, I'm sorry. Scratch that. It can outrun a buffalo can outrun a horse in a long run race. I mean, they could really haul. I mean, you know, they can get going 25, 30 miles an hour, but they have an incredible capacity just to run for, you know, a day.
A day.
Yeah, they have a lot of cooling mechanisms. Their tongue is able to pull way back in their mouth, opens up a large air chamber, so they can exchange a lot of oxygen. They can evaporate a lot of water to stay cool, and they can just go.
They can run for how many hours?
What's that?
They can run for hours at a time?
It's said that they can run for 24 hours.
Oh, my God.
At a jog, they can travel that far. It's not really known because, see, now there aren't many places where one can go, where one would then go have the ability to do that. So a lot of these observations are based on observations that other people have made. But here's the thing to consider. If a wolf, when a pack of wolves comes after a buffalo, if the buffalo starts to run, they abort the hunt.
Really?
They're interested in ones that don't want to run because they can just run so far. But there was a famous buffalo, Harvey Wallbanger was his name, and he used to go around to county fairs and circuses and race people's quarter horses. And he would quite often beat, you know, the local champ in the horse races.
That's awesome.
But I think that the thing beyond their speed, what is really noteworthy about them is the resilience to certain things, the resilience to predators, resilience to cold. They did this experiment where they tested their cold adaptability against yaks and Highland cattle and regular Hereford cattle. And they were just trying to measure at what point the buffalo's metabolism went up as a result of the cold, meaning that he would start to shiver, you know, breathe heavier as a result of the cold. And they got him down to negative 40, and his metabolic rate was still relaxing.
Wow.
Oh my God.
He was still mellowing into the cold. The Hereford cow, it got to be 10 degrees above, and the Hereford cow, that animal's metabolic rate had already increased from the cold.
By the way, the average restaurant guy, it's about 50 degrees.
10, so...
How does Stephen Ranella catch this buffalo?
Well, the area that I hunted, it has a name, DI-454, but it's a
how romantic.
You know, say it again.
I said how romantic, DI-454. It sounds beautiful.
Otherwise known as the Upper Copper River, and it's thousands of square miles, and you're given about 7 months to do the hunt, and it's the fall and winter months. The area is not accessible by road. It's only accessible by water, or you can fly into it. But you have to go into the area. The way that makes most sense and the way you can do it is you go in by raft, and then you try to hike in and find animals. There's a couple hundred of them in there, and they use a lot of this range, so they're extremely difficult to find. The other thing is, it's possible to find them in places where you'd have no hope of getting them out, because you're talking about an animal, if you get a female, maybe about 1,100 pounds. If you get a male, it could be close to 2,000 pounds. So you have to consider at once finding it, and then finding it in a place that's accessible. I wound up killing one about 3 miles from the Copper River where I could get a big raft in. And to move it one of those miles down to a small tributary stream where I could put it into a smaller raft that I could then float to my bigger raft, that took me 3 days to move it 1 mile.
How'd you do it?
About 700 pounds.
So you went hunting with a hand truck, right? How do you move a 1,000-pound animal that way?
100 pounds at a time in a backpack.
Wow.
Which,
man, you put 100 pounds on your back and start walking around, and you realize that your legs and knees just really disagree with your decision.
100 pounds of meat, no less. Well, okay. So I think that's fascinating. You're one of only four people that year that got one, right?
Steven, and you need to know that I walk around with an extra 100 pounds of meat every day. So I feel your pain.
So you'd be a great hunter. You know? I'm sorry.
So you're one of four people that got...
I lost track of the question hidden within the comment. I'm sorry.
You're one of four people who got a buffalo that year.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, your first book...
I think a lot of people don't even show up, to be honest with you. I think people get the permit, and then they start to look into... I mean, I know this for a fact, that people get the permit. They get awarded the permit, and they start looking into some of the access issues and what it's going to involve, and they don't even show up.
Well, in the backpack thing, they don't even realize.
Yeah, because I think, you know, you go, oh, it'd be so fun, I'll go to Alaska, I'll hunt a buffalo, and you start looking at maps, and you start looking at the weather, and you start factoring in all these things, and I think it's just maybe easier to sit around and watch TV.
Well, now, when you got the buffalo home, what'd you do with it?
Well, I had a couple guys I was indebted to because they had rafted me down in their raft down the Copper, and they came back and picked me up. So I gave those guys a couple hundred pounds of buffalo meat. I got all the meat back, some of it on the bone and some of it boned out. I got all the meat to Anchorage. And I processed it into, you know, basic cuts like a shank for ossobuco, and I had loin and burger and pickled tongue and, you know, heart, and I had everything like that. And I packaged it down basically down into 1 and 2 pound parcels. And then I ate for a year pretty much nothing but buffalo meat. I still have some. This is a very old recipe, arguably the first recipe ever invented. It was a thing called pemmican, where you take air-dried strips of buffalo meat, or any meat. You know, probably people used to do it with mammoth meat. You take air-dried strips of meat, pulverize it down into like a sawdust-like consistency, and then you render the fat into a lard and liquefy that lard and mix those two things together, sort of at the ratio that you use to mix instant oatmeal and water. And when that sets up, it's all that meat is encased in that layer of fat, and it becomes almost archival. Like, it just doesn't rot. It inhibits bacterial growth. It's anaerobic. I have some now. I made many pounds of pemmican, and I still have about 2 pounds of pemmican left from 2005. And I always like to say that it tastes as bad as the day I made it. That's changed a bit.
Francis and I
just had a nibble the other day. I just reach in there and grab a little bit out now and then have it. But mainly I'm kind of just seeing how long, at what point it changes. It hasn't changed any yet. And I also have about a pint of rendered fat still. And I have my skull, which occupies a very prominent position in my house. And then I have the robe, which is like a great, very thick winter blanket.
Francis and I just recently interviewed somebody who did a book on the old WPA files, and in that book there are recipes kind of from each region and each land, and there's a recipe for pemmican in the old WPA cookbook.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
a friend of mine who has a restaurant in Manhattan, he has been making a pemmican for his charcuterie platter. But what he's doing is he's binding it. Instead of binding it with tallow, he's binding it with pine nuts, which is kind of traditional because people would put pine nuts in there. But it gives a much better flavor when you put some pine nut and fruit in there. And then he cheats with salt and pepper and all that kind of
fancy stuff.
All the fancy things, you know.
Yeah. Now, what can you tell us the name of the restaurant?
It's Inside Park at St. Bart's Cathedral.
Oh, yeah, I've been there. That's great. That's great.
Yeah, Chef Matt Weingarten. Me and him are big time sausage making buddies. So when I get back from a hunt, we'll usually get together and he helps me create all kinds of cool sausages. So.
Well, Steve Marinello, thanks for being on the show. The book is wonderful. If you out there want to find out more about it, it's American Buffalo in Search of a Lost Icon by Steven Marinello. And you can find out more about that at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. I would like to announce the most exciting new project Mark and I have launched in years. We've teamed up with some old friends, Mike and Jennifer Schnurr, and worked with our chefs and purveyors of artisanal food products to create RestaurantGuysChocolate.com. Yeah, baby, we've created a line of extraordinary and delicious chocolates in a palette of thoughtful and complex flavors. They're sexy, they come in a great, beautiful red box, they're handmade, and they make a perfect gift or a perfect personal indulgence. We ship overnight, or you can pick them up at the restaurants. The website is RestaurantGuysChocolate.com, or find the link at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. We put our heart and soul into every box, and each one's made by hand. There's a little bit of my soul in every piece of candy, that's right, and a little bit of Mark's too. So check out RestaurantGuysChocolate.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis.
In that last segment, Stephen was talking about pemmican and making pemmican and how it can last for 3-4 years, and how even from his buffalo hunt in 05, he's still got some pemmican left that he reaches for and he grabs. Didn't sound like he likes it very much.
No.
And the other thing is, just here's a rule, and you know, you can know this about me right now. If there's something in my refrigerator or my cupboard that I really, really like, it never lasts 4 years. Okay, I don't care how big that buffalo was.
Well, you know, here's a little historical fact. I never understood, and I'm remembering a scene now that because it didn't all come together until we were talking to Steven. But do you remember the movie, the classic Western, Little Big Man?
Mm-hmm, of course.
In Little Big Man, he's captured by Indians, remember? Mm-hmm. And when he's first captured, and he's tied to like a wagon wheel or something, and they're feeding him, they make him like a slave, right? And they're feeding him what looks like fat, and he says it's spoiled fat, and he won't eat it because it's disgusting. I'm 100% certain that was pemmican in Little Big Man, and because that was an Indian staple, and they weren't feeding him. And I thought, oh, how cruel, they're feeding him the spoiled fat. But no, that's what they ate. It was as unseasoned, confit, dried buffalo. It doesn't sound very appetizing. And
I think if we did that, we'd do it differently now.
Yeah, like he
was saying, his friend, you know, a little salt, a little pepper, some
pine nuts.
We'd put pine nuts in there, some confectionaries. It would taste differently than it does.
All right, well, that's all we've got for you. I hope you enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.